WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, January the 8th. Cloudy today, a 40% chance of rain mixed with snow, a high today of 40 degrees with winds up to 40 miles per hour. The rain-snow system is still well to our west. It is 38 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. Winds are beginning to pick up now. They're from the southwest at 14. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. The next few minutes of WGTD's morning show are going to be spent talking about a lot of what occupies our time and our energy. And it's sort of an invisible drain upon our energy and time and focus. It is something that my morning show guest likes to call life admin, A-D-M-I-N. It's sort of the administrative stuff of life, the paperwork and other sort of logistical stuff that often we are dealing with but not fully conscious of. And in certain households, in certain relationships, often the brunt of life admin is borne by one partner much more than the other. And often it is work that is largely invisible. And even the person who's bearing the responsibility often is not fully aware of just how much they are doing of that sort of thing and the impact that it might be having on them, on their health, on their own well-being, on the well-being of the relationship, on the health of the whole household. All of this and much more is explored in a really interesting new book called Life Admin, How I Learned to Do Less, Do Better, and Live More. The author of the book is Elizabeth F. Emmons, who is the Isidore and Seville Sulzbacher Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. And she writes this as someone who has dealt with this issue very much before, borne the costs of it in more ways than one, and has spoken with all kinds of different people about how they manage the many and various challenges that are part of this so-called life admin. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Professor Elizabeth Emmons, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Greg.
I learned a lot reading your book, and I really enjoyed it quite a lot. One of the things I wanted to say about it, and I hope you won't misunderstand this question or misunderstand my intention, is that I'm really impressed that someone of your sterling credentials is taking the time to write a book like this, a book which sort of falls under that category of self-help. And there are all kinds of people who kind of make their career out of manufacturing one self-help book after another, many of which are not even, in my opinion, really worth the time. I think you've written a really substantial book here, but I'm really sort of impressed and maybe even surprised as well that somebody whose own professional life has to be so rich and demanding, wants to take the time to write a book about something like this. Can you just say a word about that, and maybe tied up into that answer can be a little bit about why you were prompted or felt compelled to take the time to do this?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. That's a really terrific question. I was propelled on this journey to research and write about life admin by my own life, as you said, by finding myself completely overwhelmed by this kind of invisible work. And at first I thought it was just my problem. And then I looked around and realized that everyone else around me seemed to be doing varying amounts of this invisible office work also. And when I started writing about it, so I got interested in it. I thought there were some interesting legal angles as well as human angles. And so I started writing about it as a regular law review article, the way I do as my profession demands. And I started presenting it to law professors around the country and actually in some other countries, just as part of my job. And people responded to this so intensely. I had law professors coming up to me and saying, you know, I've never had an academic paper so perfectly describe my life, or you've seen right into my marriage. How did you do that? And I realized that people were finding real relief in having this named and discussed. And also knowing that it wasn't just their individual problem, and also that they didn't have to solve it all themselves. And so I set on this journey of interviewing people and holding brainstorming sessions in order to try to understand better how people were dealing with this and how they were responding to it to make it better. And so because I think there's a culture change as well as change to law and markets that needs to happen and changes we can make in our individual lives, I really felt I needed to spread the word. I needed to write this in a way that I hoped could reach people so there might be relief for more people than the small sector of the world I reach in my academic work.
Mm. You also write in the book about how, in some respects, this has been also a very personal story that involved you and your marriage to your wife, and how, while in no way, shape, or form was some of the issues surrounding life admin the cause of ultimately your separation and divorce, that the difficulties there, the imbalance, the maybe lack of understanding or appreciation around this was reflective of other issues that were going on that in a marriage that in a sense was maybe already in trouble. So this issue didn't cause the rift, the ultimate rift, but it was kind of reflective of it. And I suspect that you would tell us that this is probably the case in many relationships and marriages, that in some ways the problems that might surround this issue can be kind of like the canary in the coal mine. It can be really indicative of what is going on and just how healthy or unhealthy a relationship is.
Absolutely. The people I interviewed revealed to me that life admin was often, as we talked about it and they then saw it more clearly as a thing, that this was really often a cause of real resentment. And as you say, a kind of sign of the health of the relationship. I did interview some people who had happy relationships around admin, and that was really fun, and I write about that in a chapter on relationship tips and ideas. But it's also true that one of the things I saw in this journey is that, you know, divorce is always really hard. Anyone who's been through divorce or knows someone who has closely knows that. But what people don't tend to recognize is that the emotional suffering of something painful like divorce or the sickness of a loved one or death of a loved one, that emotional suffering is really compounded by this huge onslaught of invisible office work that hits you. You know, when you face separation and divorce, you're suddenly on this legal journey. And I was trained as a lawyer, and I still found it completely overwhelming. And one bright spot of this process was that focusing on life admin, recognizing it as a thing, helped me realize both ways to make it better as I was going through the divorce process, and also helped me see that there are people out there, usually on any journey you're on, especially a painful one, who've done it before you and who are really happy to download all that information in their head that they didn't want anyway, but they had to learn themselves to help you navigate it and pass that along.
Hmm. We're speaking with Elizabeth Emmons about her book, Life Admin, How I Learned to Do Less, Do Better, and Live More. probably closer to the top of the interview, we should have taken the time to do this, but it would be helpful, I think, to our listeners to have you spell out a really rich, full definition of what you mean by this term life admin, which you say in the introduction is the office-type work that it takes to run a life and a household. But tell us more, because this is something that extends beyond the obvious, beyond what we might think of in those terms.
Absolutely. So life admin is the invisible office work that takes up our time and drains our energy. It's the kind of work that managers and secretaries, also known as admins, get paid to do in an office, but that we do invisibly and for free in our lives. So they're daily and routine things like paying bills or dealing with taxes, and also aggravating one-offs like lost luggage admin or broken technology admin. And big life events come with a lot of this work, both the painful ones I mentioned, you know, including divorce or an aging, ailing parent or a child, but also happy events like a new baby or a wedding can come with huge amounts of this. And life admin sounds trivial. It sounds like tiny things, but it really can add up. So, you know, as an example, the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA form that students applying to college or often their parents have to fill out, you know, the FAFSA cost U.S. families 30 million hours last year, which is huge. And people fail to refinance their mortgages. One study found 20% of U.S. households that could benefit from refinancing fail to do that, and that there's a foregone savings of $5.4 billion there. And often this is just because someone fails to open the mail, which as somebody with a tendency to develop a pile of mail in my hallway, I can see how that would happen. So it's big stuff, but it seems little.
Right. One of the questions I had about this is you're obviously writing this book basically for the here and now. And I wonder how much some of these issues are different now versus 20 years ago, or especially 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I would assume that that we're talking about lives that are more complicated when it comes to much of this, and also that for all the technology that now exists that would supposedly make all of this easier, that perhaps, in effect, some of that technology actually makes a lot of this actually even more difficult to navigate. What would you have to say about what this is like now versus once upon a time, long before you were even thinking about this issue?
You are exactly right. There's always been admin, but there's more of it now, and it feels different. So when we carry around these devices that can bombard us constantly with demands from the outside world and ever-increasing demands that we respond more quickly. There's a kind of escalation, right? See, people get overwhelmed by their email inboxes, and then other people know that the way to get a quick reply is to text you. And so then everything comes in by text, and then there is a sense that you need to reply quickly. And so we're bombarded with this work in a moment-to-moment way that makes it very hard to get in a flow with anything else in our lives or be present, show up for what we're doing.
One of the choices you made in your book is to outline a matrix of four different admin personalities. And I'm anxious for you to kind of spell those out for our listeners so they can maybe get a sense of where they might fall within that matrix. But I'm also curious to know why you wanted to do that, and why you think it's helpful to kind of spell it out, and if there are any pitfalls to creating such a matrix that people, in a sense, might misuse or use too simplistically, because I suspect, and you say so in your book, that there's actually some flow, some fluidity between these various personality types, maybe depending on life circumstances or what kind of admin we're talking about.
Yeah, so the four personalities that I uncovered in this study of life admin are the super doer, the reluctant doer, the admin avoider, and the admin denier. So the first two are basically doing it or getting it done, and the last two are not doing it. And the differences then, the nuances are about how it feels. So the super doer is doing it and feeling pretty good about it. The reluctant doer is doing it but really wishing they didn't have to be doing it. That's where I often exist. The admin avoider is not doing it and feeling bad, you know, guilty or embarrassed about the consequences when they catch up with the person. And that's how I am with my snail mail. And then the admin denier is not doing it but not feeling so bad because the admin denier doesn't see a problem. The admin denier doesn't really think admin's a thing at all, and this tends to be reserved for people, young people or people who've been privileged to have somebody who really does this for them kind of seamlessly and invisibly so they don't have to face it. And you raise the pitfalls of this. You know, one of the worries I have in putting this out there is that people will think it's just like a hierarchy, like the best thing to be is a super doer, and then everything below that is less than that. I have a quiz at the back of the book, and some of my relatives who will go unnamed briefly took the quiz and then came back telling me they were super doers. And I have to say I was a little bit surprised. And I don't think my dad would mind my saying that he admitted that it was hard not to pick the answer that you thought would be the super doer, because who doesn't want to be a super doer? Who doesn't
right.
want to be called super at something, right? But I really found that you know, while some of these categories feel better than others, and, you know, we're all a mix, most of us are a mix, I think, of these different characters in different parts of our lives or different relationships, but we can learn things from each of the personalities. And so my chapter on individual strategies is organized around the personalities. So, for instance, an avoider strategy is trusting. So trusting that the neighbors near your new home know when to put their garbage out. So rather than calling up the sanitation department or looking online or trying to see if they sent you a letter, you just poke your head out every day and look and see, oh, okay, that's the day. So trusting is an avoider kind of strategy, something that it's possible to learn from somebody who's really trying to avoid any extra admin that they can. And so one of the uses I find of these personalities is that it can be hard if you read a book or a part of a book, even if you can find the time that aims to help us live better, you can end that process feeling like, oh my gosh, now I have a million things I have to remember about how to try to make my life better, and it can just be adding to your to-do list. But the personalities offer a way in to, you know, through the quiz, understanding yourself a little better, but then also trying out another way to approach things for a little while. Like, let me see, what would it feel like to be an avoider this week? You know, and I might remember some strategies from the book, or I might come up with my own through it. So that's part of what I see as the virtue of it.
I think that makes so much sense. And it's actually one of the most intriguing things about the book and the way that you are talking about this. I think you're so right when you say that much of what you talk about here, this is how you open chapter one. This book is about something most people think is both trivial and boring. And so when you think about it, I mean, what could be a sterner challenge for the author of such a book than to try to approach this in a way that's really going to be engaging and interesting? And I think you really do it. And just in what you were kind of laying out with a very kind of rich and nuanced approach to this idea of different kind of admin personality types, that just kind of, I think, underscores the way in which you've really tried to treat this subject in a very rich, deep way, and not just skimming the surface, telling us the obvious.
Well, Greg, that really makes my heart sing, that you both found it interesting, but also that you found it enjoyable, because that was a dilemma that plagued me while writing the book was, you know, how do you write a book for people who have no time about having no time? And, you know, trying to, you know, make it as interesting as possible and as useful as possible. So I've spread ideas throughout the book and strategies that people can try. but also collected them at the end in these ideas to try, where, you know, so you don't have to make a list of the things to remember at the end that you might want to try out. But, you know, making it pleasurable in some way was really one of my goals, because we that's part of the living more, right? How do we find pleasure in these things that we all have to face?
Right. And one of the things you point out, and I think we've already touched on it briefly, is that there are some people who really do like life admin, or at least certain aspects of it. And that's also sometimes lost in a book like this, which, you know, can so easily focus on just the headache that it is for so many people, that there are some people who actually seem to thrive. But even for them, it's important that this work that they are doing is understood and acknowledged.
Absolutely. And I found that, well, no one likes that I spoke to and interviewed likes insurance admin. There's certain kinds of admin that no one seems to like to deal with. But a big surprise of my research was how many people enjoy at least some kinds of admin some of the time when they make time for it, when it's not happening in the margins of everything else, but there's a kind of dedicated window to address it. So it becomes real in that way. One of my proudest avoiders that I interviewed talked about being on an overseas flight and doing his taxes. And he said, you know, it actually wasn't so bad, you know, and people compared it to doing a crossword puzzle, say, doing something like that. Anybody who's made a list, a to-do list, and then added things just to cross them off, things you've already done, you know, knows how there can be a kind of pleasure in the completion of these tasks, because so many things in our lives aren't easily completed. And so there can be a kind of pleasure. And so I have a whole chapter on pleasures and inviting people to think about where they have a better chance at pleasure. You know, some people really like to do things with the latest apps and technology. And many of my interviewees, though, had really gone back to paper and prefer that. And so knowing something about yourself in this can be one way to make it better.
Hmm. By the way, one of the first major points you make in your book is that it is really important for us to think about this as labor. Why is that so important, that we attach the term labor to this matter of life admin? What do we gain by doing that?
Seeing it as labor helps make it real. So at an individual level, it helps us appreciate ourselves and each other for doing it. You know, if you cook a really big, beautiful meal, you spend all day doing it for somebody else, there's a pretty good chance that you'll get thanked afterwards. If you spend the day at the DMV, it's much less likely that you're going to get a big, heartfelt thanks for that. And so understanding it as labor can help with that. But the other thing it does is it helps us understand some changes that should happen at the societal and legal level. So when a company wastes our time, let's say your cell phone company overbills you and you have to fight them for hours and hours in their phone tree and so on in order to get credit back for that money, you should be able to get compensated for your lost time, even if they give you your money back. But courts routinely tell people that lost personal time doesn't count. But if you were a company and from a breach of contract, another company wasted your employee's time, that employee labor would count. You would get compensation for their hourly wages. But when it's just our personal time, which we can't really get back, we don't get that compensation. And most people aren't going to have time to sue companies. But if a few people do, which a few people have tried, and occasionally these suits get somewhere, but basically they don't, then, you know, companies would change the way they treat our time.
Hmm. Interesting. I so appreciate the fact that you take a little bit of time in your book to talk about this in a context that I think the typical book about this would completely ignore. And that is the fact that people who are living in poverty often bear a ferocious burden when it comes to life admin. And again, it's so easy to write a book like this from the perspective of where you are, you as the author, and your circle of friends or the people whom you have spoken with, and so easily people living in poverty would be completely left out of the picture. You have some interesting things to say about how people in poverty face even more difficult challenges in many respects when it comes to life admin. Spell some of those out for us, if you would.
One is that the stakes of poverty admin are generally higher. So people of means can ignore their snail mail for a week or more. You know, the mail can pile up in my hallway. That's a privilege I have. If you're depending on public benefits, delays in opening your mail can lead to losing your home, you know, or your food. The tone of the interactions is often different. Wealthy people often do admin with private entities that want their business. It's not the same if you're dealing with public entities staffed by overworked frontline workers. But also, it's a lot harder to do the office work of life without an actual office and office equipment. You know, if you don't have a scanner and a photocopier that you can access readily, how do you do the make those fill out those forms and get them submitted? It's a lot harder. And yet, one of the messages for me in the book is that it's also important. We want to understand each other, and we also want to see that even though some people's admin is harder than yours, whatever yours is, yours still can be painful. That we can understand each other and see each other and get some more admin compassion, I think, in all directions.
Hmm. I also want to give you a chance to talk about a really intriguing term. The word itself is very ordinary, but the way you use it is kind of out of the ordinary. And that is the term sticky, and how some admin is sticky or has a sticky quality to it. Explain to our listeners what you're talking about here. It's quite intriguing.
Mm-hmm. You know, one story captures this pretty well. A woman I interviewed told me how she and her husband made a cross-country drive about 10 years earlier for a new home, new jobs. And as they drove, they took turns. One would drive and the other one would call up to set up their utilities, and then they'd switch. And she said that 10 years later, they were each still paying the bills that they had signed up for on that drive. It was an accident of who had been driving at which point as to who signed up for which bills. Admin is sticky. It tends to stick where it lands. And this can be true of, you know, lots of work, but it's even more true of admin for a lot of reasons, including that it's really information heavy. You tend to have to know things and know people to do admin. So that's why it's easier to do the dishes in somebody else's house than to make their grocery list, right? Dishes are a physical chore, and making a grocery list is the admin part of going grocery shopping. It's the planning and deciding part of the task. And so once you know that admin is sticky, you can understand better its pathways, how people end up doing. Some people end up doing more of it than others. And you can also use that information to help unstick the way admin is currently divvied up in your home or your relationships.
Right. So there are probably certain tasks that, because they are so simple, they tend to flow back and forth. I mean, I think in a lot of households, although not in mine, who takes the garbage out could very easily flip back and forth between partners and even shared with the kids if there are kids in the home or whatever. But other tasks that require, in a sense, more skill and especially more knowledge and more sort of back knowledge, those are the kind of things that we would be very reluctant to, you know, flip back and forth. It's very easy for that task, however oppressive it might become, to stick to one particular person.
Exactly. Exactly. So the person who makes the first call to the exterminator usually owns that task. And the person who maybe puts an app in their phone to order something online usually keeps being the one to order it.
Interesting. And if we don't stop to think about it, we can be so easily unaware of that quality. Well, in whatever time remains, I want to be sure to have you just give a little attention to what much of your book is about, namely how people can make this better, address some of the issues and problems that can arise around life admin. I love how you put it early in the book when you say, we can make life choices that reduce or distribute or detoxify admin. And that's so interesting to think about, in particular, that last notion of detoxifying admin. Explain what you're saying there, or why you say it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, so one of the ways that we can make it better is by, you know, doing less of it. So I talk a lot about different ideas I've gathered from people about how to do that, including things like, you know, taking photos of forms and information, you know, rather than scanning them, or writing NNR on the end of texts and emails, which I write now to mean no need to respond, so we can make things end and have the exchanges not keep going on. But some of the time, we just have to face this work. Some of the time, it just has to get done, and especially until we can make some changes in our law and our society, we're going to have to face it. And so then there are ways we can make it feel less bad, and one is by recognizing that it's work. Another way is to sometimes do it alongside other people. I found that at least some of the people I held brainstorming sessions with and interviews with were really excited by an idea of having admin study hall, where you meet up with a friend, maybe a friend who's far away or a family member, on the phone or on a video conference or something, and you say, spend an hour, and you say, hello, this is what I'm going to work on, and then you're kind of in a working side by side, and then it makes it real, and it takes something really isolated and can make it more pleasant, collaborative, and somebody recognizes what you're doing. But also, you can begin to see it and say thank you to people for doing it, and that's part of how you can detoxify. You can take out that sense of resentment that builds when it feels like the other person in your house just doesn't see what you're doing. And so having it become visible for all of us is one way we can take out the kind of toxic quality of resentment that can grow up in relationships.
Well, I have to end on a personal note by saying that I happen to be somebody married to a woman who bears almost 100% of the life admin in our household. And fleetingly from time to time thought about that, realized that, and I hope once or twice I've said thank you, but not very often. And certainly I've never stopped to think about what that means for a marriage and for a relationship when one partner is paying all the bills and doing so much of all of this that is so often invisible work and unacknowledged work. So your book on a very personal level gives me a whole lot to think about. And I suspect for a lot of people listening to this conversation, they're probably thinking about this as well, whether or not they're on one side of that divide or the other. And so I really appreciate this opportunity to talk with you about your fascinating book, again called Life Admin, How I Learned to Do Less, Do Better, and Live More, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and the author, Elizabeth F. Emmons. Professor Emmons, thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you about your really, really interesting book, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for saying what you said at the end, too. That's really beautiful to acknowledge what your partner's doing. That's beautiful. Have a great day.
You too. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is from the archives. I'm excited for the next few minutes here on WGTD as I speak today with Donald A. Norman, the Breed Professor of Design at Northwestern University, a former vice president of Apple Computer, a partner in the Nielsen Norman Group consulting firm, which consults with a variety of corporations on the question of design. And he's written a number of different books about design, including one which has just been released called
The Design of Future Things, in which Professor Norman explores some really intriguing questions about how and why we design some of the innovative things which we do, and some of the questions which we need to ask and maybe don't always ask about exactly what we want, exactly what we need, the way things work, and the way in which we sometimes misunderstand the nature of some of the things which we create.
No. It's the things that misunderstand us. Let's get our priorities straight.
Yes, very good. Again, the book is called The Design of Future Things, and it is published by Basic Books. And Professor Norman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Ahead of talking specifically about your book, I wonder if you could give me just a little idea of how you found yourself in the field of design itself. I mean, does this go back a long time, maybe even into your childhood?
It may. I just, in fact, wrote an essay for someone who asked me that question, and I said, it was a radio back in the old days when I was a child, and I peered into the mysterious innards of a radio and wondered, gee, what's going on? What's moving? How does it work? Because all these mechanical things, you could push a lever and see it work something. So you could figure it out. But with a radio, there was nothing in there, just glowing tubes. This was really a long time ago, so they had something called vacuum tubes that nobody today remembers.
Hmm. That comment reminds me of something that actually came up on this program not long ago when I spoke to an engineer, actually, about a book which he has written, kind of celebrating what engineers do and designers. And he has a whole section of his book in which he talks about and has photographs which depict the notion of the facade and the fact that so much of what we build now is built in such a way that the workings of things are hidden. I mean, very much on purpose, so we don't see what's actually going on. And, of course,
when it comes to electronics, there's no choice. The workings of a computer are done by mysterious green electrons. They really are green, you know. Mysterious green electrons that whiz about. And so inside the circuitry, there is nothing to be seen. And if you open up one of these boxes, you see, well, little black rectangles. So we're at the mercy of some designer. Somebody is sitting someplace at 2 a.m. saying, oh, I got a neat idea. And who decides that the way you should change your alarm clock time is by holding down this button, pushing those two, and hoping you get the right time.
Hmm.
And for him, it's perfectly logical. Gee, why would anybody have trouble with this? If you have trouble with this, you shouldn't be using it.
Hmm.
So that's my old book. My new book is I've seen the future, and I don't like it. We're now putting intelligence in these devices. So I'm driving my car, and I try to switch lanes, and the car says, no, I won't let you switch lanes. Ask the permission first. The turn signal, which you used to use to tell other cars you want to switch lane, that's now how you tell your own car you want to switch a lane. Your refrigerator will say, you can't have that cake. It's not on your diet. Your house will say, you're in a bad mood today. I'm playing your favorite music. What do you mean you don't want that music? Why is it your favorite then? That's what I'm worried about.
Let me ask you about something that you say in the first chapter of your book, which is called Cautious Cars and Cantankerous Kitchens. And I think you've just touched on a couple of tangible examples of exactly that. You say machines have less power than humans, so they have more authority. And you kind of anticipate our reaction by saying contradictory, yes, but oh so true. Help us understand what you're saying there. Machines have less power than humans, so they have more authority.
When you call up your phone company to complain about the bill or to change something, or when you go to any store and talk to the clerk and you complain, what does the clerk say? The clerk says, I don't know, I just work here. I don't, you know, doesn't know what to do. The clerk doesn't set the rules. Therefore, the clerk has more authority over you. You're hopeless, helpless. Both hopeless and helpless. You cannot argue with the clerk because the clerk has no authority. That's the way it is with our intelligent devices. If your car suddenly decides to brake because it thinks that you're driving dangerously, you can't convince it that it's perfectly safe because you can't talk to it. That's why People with less power have more power.
You just talked about not being able to really communicate with one's car, for instance. I think one of the points of your book is that we sometimes misunderstand something that sort of seems like communication on the surface as not being communication at all. You say that the communication capability of given machines is not communication at all because it's two monologues rather than a dialogue. Explain that a little further.
Right. Engineers love to talk about human-machine communication, and we talk about human-machine interaction. But it's not real interaction. It's because we command our machines. We do that by setting a switch or pushing a button or choosing a menu item. And it does something, and then it commands us by giving us something back, and we have to choose, or it says, I'm about to crash. Okay? Oh, sure. We have no choice. So that's not real communication. We send messages to it. It sends messages to us. There are two monologues. And as you say, two monologues are not a dialogue.
So you posed the question shortly thereafter, then, how can we change the way we interact with our machines to take better advantage of their strengths and virtues and at the same time eliminate their annoyances? To what extent is that possible?
Well, my favorite machine is a calculator. The calculator doesn't work at all like the human brain. It doesn't pretend to. And actually, that's its virtue. We make mistakes when we do arithmetic and computations, and the calculator doesn't. So it works completely differently than us, and it's a very good assistant because many of us find it absolutely essential. And actually, modern science couldn't be done without the powerful calculators that scientists use. But it's a tool. It doesn't go off and decide, oh, this is a better problem to solve, or it doesn't say, why are you solving this problem, or that's not a good method, here's a better method. It lets us be in control, and it provides us with advice, and it takes over the stuff that we find hard and lets us do the stuff that we do well. That's a good example.
It's interesting you say that about, I mean, the calculator does something for us that we perhaps don't necessarily want to do or need to do ourselves. That is, of course, what a lot of inventors and designers do when they attempt to automate certain things. You point out, however, that pretty much without exception, when we give a machine, when we automate it, we are only partially automating it. And we sometimes forget that it is an incomplete automation. And so we are still sort of left hanging, needing to sort of hover and be ready to intervene when something goes wrong or when it's necessary for us to sort of take over. You paint a picture there in which we're not really being helped maybe as much as we might think by that partial automation.
Right, but you see, you yourself slipped into this nasty language of kind of blaming the person for the problem. You say, we sometimes forget that it's not fully automated. Wait a minute. Why should it be our responsibility? It should be the machine's responsibility. So it should be the designer's responsibility not to let us get into that situation. You know, lots of accidents are blamed on human error. In fact, most accidents, something like 75 to 85% are blamed on human error. Now, wait a minute. You know, if so much is blamed on human error, maybe it isn't humans at all. Maybe we're asking people to do things that they can't do very well, like pay continuous, complete attention for an 8-hour work shift. Nobody can do that. Most people can't. I bet you everybody has drifted off during this very conversation and hasn't attended to every single word. Drifting off for 10 seconds, 30 seconds, an hour is not uncommon. So why don't we design things that take this into account? People make mistakes when there's a big, long row of switches. We sometimes flip the wrong switch. Many of us have turned on or off the wrong burner on our stoves. So, we know that this happens. Why don't we design equipment to take this into account? So let's not fall into this deadly trap of saying, oh, sometimes people forget. Nah.
Granted. Okay, I understand your point. But a little later in your book, you say, in posing this really intriguing question of how we can cooperate most usefully with our machines, you say we need to regard the interaction somewhat as we do interaction with animals. I mean, the way you phrased that is, I mean, at least some of the responsibility is ours to understand these tools that we're purchasing with our own money and that we are choosing to use.
Yes, that's true, but I think the main responsibility lies in the heads of the designers and the engineers to really understand people better. They pride themselves in understanding the machines and the technology, but we've got to understand the people, so again, we don't put people into these circumstances. And mind you, we can have great success. The best example is air traffic, commercial aviation. Lots of people have studied automation and the use of aviation for years and years, and so many of my examples were drawn from aviation, but people in aviation learn their lessons. So now flying an airplane is one of the most safe activities you can do. We sometimes go for years without any deaths in commercial aviation. That's not true in any other of these sports. So, sports, activities.
Can you help us understand why that success has been achieved in that particular arena and not in these others that we're talking about? What's different about that particular technology and the way it's been developed?
Well, there are several differences. One of them is the extreme care and attention that has been given to the design with teams of designers that include social scientists who study and understand people. However, in many ways, the aviation situation is easier than, say, the automobile situation. Because in an airplane, you have two very highly trained pilots who have been practiced on all sorts of problems in simulators, which are really realistic. If I put you in a simulator, you would not distinguish it from a real airplane. It's that good. And they practiced every possible emergency situation that one can imagine. So that's one big thing. Well-trained, well-practiced. And second time, you're in your airplane, everything goes wrong, the airplane starts diving to Earth, you still have 2 or 3 minutes. And there have been several cases where, when this happens, the pilots save the airplane. In the automobile, you have an ill-trained driver who probably isn't paying attention. And when something goes wrong, you may have a half second to respond. So the situation is much more complex.
Hmm. We're speaking with Donald A. Norman. We're talking about his brand-new book called The Design of Future Things. Perhaps you know him from a previous book called The Design of Everyday Things. You say we are in the midst of a major change in how we relate to technology. Until recently, people have been in control. We turned the technology on and off, told it which operation to perform, and guided it through its operation. But you paint a picture now of technology becoming more powerful and complex, in which we understand it less and can predict its actions much less. It's really interesting to think about that, and the way you describe that, it's truly unsettling.
Yeah, that was the point.
And again, Mr. Norman's book is titled The Design of All Things. We played this out of the morning show archives today. The book is published by Basic Books. Tomorrow on the morning show, I am excited to reconnect with Mick Burke, who is business reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. And we're going to be talking with Mick Burke primarily about the Foxconn development in Mount Pleasant. Probably the biggest story, undoubtedly the biggest story that Mick Burke has followed in his long journalistic career. And we will find out how things are going thus far and what is likely ahead. On Thursday, Nan Calvert will be paying her monthly visit to the program. And on Friday, we look forward to another visit from political science professor Gerald Mast. We'll see if the government shutdown is still in effect, and if so, what effect that is likely to have on all of our lives, and also what is ahead for us politically as the U.S. House of Representatives goes into Democratic hands. We'll also talk about the political situation here in Wisconsin as well. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.